Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Breast cancer has long been a fixation and affliction of the industrialized West. Now, women from Africa to Asia face the same scourge in ever larger numbers, most with only a fraction of the medical tests and treatments available here, and often in a deadly culture of silence. This hour, On Point, Breast Cancer and Awareness Go Global, we'll look at the growing international crisis in women's health. You can join the conversation. What happens if the 1-in-8 ratio of women hit in the United States becomes closer to a global norm? And what is it about breast cancer that punishes women as soon as life gets a little easier, an economy a little better? And where do we really stand here in the U.S.? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me first today from New York is Kathleen Kingsbury. She's a Shanghai-based correspondent for Time magazine and was lead reporter for this week's Time cover story, The Changing Face of Breast Cancer. Kathleen Kingsbury, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's a striking cover with a woman and across her chest a map of the world. What did you find in your big effort here on looking at global breast cancer trends?
We looked at several continents. We included countries in North America, Latin America, Africa, Asia, and Europe, and the Middle East, looking at a growing trend of the incidence of breast cancer rising. One thing that we learned that was startling is that by 2020, 70% of new cases of breast cancer will be in the developing world.
What does it matter if the incidence shifts regionally, geographically? Isn't it all the same everywhere?
It is, Tom. But the fact of the matter is that women in the developing world do not have access to things like early detection and then the most advanced treatment. Also, one thing that we found that was very, very upsetting was the fact that most women aren't willing to talk about the pain and suffering that they're feeling. They're afraid that they will become a burden to their family or that their husbands will leave them, for example, if they go public with the fact that they have a problem in their breasts.
Now, that means that combination of less diagnosis, less available treatment, and that inhibition on talking about it means very different outcomes. I'm looking here at a big world map you put together with breast cancer incidence and then comparing that with death rates. And while in the United States and Western Europe, absolutely the world leaders, sadly, in incidence of breast cancer, the percentage of women who end up dying from that cancer is way down by, 20%, whereas when you go on down into North Africa, South Central Asia, East Africa, Middle Africa, it's almost 1-to-1. You get it, you die.
Yes, startling. For example, in India, almost 50% of women who have breast cancer will not receive treatment for the disease. The one thing that we concluded is that early detection has always been the golden rule in breast cancer. Mm-hmm. The earlier you detect the cancer, the more likely it is to be able to be cured or at least to ease your suffering. That's not happening in the developing world.
What are you finding? What are medical researchers finding here, Kathleen? Is there believed to be a rising incidence, in straight numbers, or is it just a rising awareness of breast cancer as people talk about it a little more?
Absolutely, the number of detected cases is on the rise, but that only accounts for a very small percentage of the rise in incidence rates. For example, things like a Western diet being introduced to a country will affect it more so than the number of detections.
So it's not just simple incidents. I mean, simple numbers. It comes out of lifestyle and it comes out of awareness. Could you share with us some of the stories of particular women that you and your reporters talk to around the world and what they face when it comes to grappling with breast cancer?
Absolutely. One woman that I met in Shanghai, for example, had never heard of breast cancer. She didn't know that she could be diagnosed with it. She didn't know what a mastectomy was. She didn't know what a mammogram was. She found out that she had breast cancer during a routine exam that her company recommended, and then proceeded to basically, in the next 2 months, go through having her breast removed, going through radiation, chemotherapy, and then ultimately she's is now recovering, but it was a very trying time for her. Other things we heard were things like, in India, women who weren't allowed to feed their children with their hands because people thought the disease was contagious. In Bangladesh, women who have had mastectomies, it's basically akin to widowhood. They lose their husbands and their families. Other misconceptions out there. For example, a woman we spoke with in Brazil recounted the story of a young mother who thought she might get breast cancer if her daughter burped during breastfeeding.
So a lot of cultural and awareness issues to deal with. And as you said, wrote in the article, fear as well, the Chinese woman you talked to saying, I had never heard of anyone in China with cancer who didn't die. So the sense that
Absolutely.
You learn about it and it sounds like a death sentence.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reoccurring themes that we heard around the world was simply the idea that there's no way to treat cancer if you have it. So many women don't even seek treatment because they believe that it'll be a waste of money or a burden to their family that will just ultimately lead to their death.
Kathleen Kingsbury, normally in Shanghai, China, with us today from New York. Kathleen, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation as well from Seattle, Dr. Peggy Porter. She's head of the breast cancer program at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. She and her colleagues have been trying to track the changes in lifestyle and more in the developing world that may be leading to a global rise in breast cancer. Peggy Porter, Dr. Porter, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's your assessment, first of all, in what's going on? Do you see a rise or just more awareness? And whichever it is, what's driving it?
Well, I think that Kathleen is correct in that there are two things happening. One, of course, if you start looking for breast cancer, detecting it, the incidence will rise. You're going to find more, and the incidence will look like it's going up. Mm-hmm. I think that there are some countries where the real incidence is going up, and that's certainly true of China, where they have pretty good numbers, and it's clear that it's been on the rise over the last 10 years.
What is your early assessment of why that's happening?
Well, there are several things, and you know, the idea that adopting the Western style, certainly part of it.
Western diet, style of what? A diet, you said?
Well, yeah, I think that's mm-hmm. why I'm going to define mm-hmm. Western style, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of factors that go into a Western style. Diet's one of them. Mm-hmm. Sort of a more office-based life might be one of them where you get less exercise. But I think one of the things that happened, some things that we know, for instance, is that breast cancer and risk is really increased by reproductive life events. And that includes when you have your children and how many children you have. Now, of course, China has gone from a generation that had 4 to 5 kids, maybe even more, to a generation that has only one child. And I think that that also has really impacted the increased incidence of breast cancer in China.
Because fewer children or children, is it later in life or earlier, is likely, creates a more welcome
environment
for
breast cancer. If you have your children early in life and mm-hmm. have lots of children, you're at a decreased risk. And I'm saying that as if it's a single woman at decreased risk. But it's actually, if we look at the whole population,
right.
we see that if the group of women who has children early and has a lot of children, they are less likely to get breast cancer than the group of women who had one child or no child and had that child later.
Kathleen Kingsbury, there was a very striking emphasis in your Time cover story on ethnicity or race. You've got a headline here, Ethnicity as Destiny, and you wrote, of all the things that can determine a woman's chances of surviving breast cancer, perhaps one of the most powerful is the simple matter of race. We're not quite accustomed to hearing race called out in that way lately. What do you mean by that? What did you find?
One thing we found is that most studies right now show that both Asian women as well as black women in the U.S. and Africa are at a higher risk of developing a more aggressive form of breast cancer that's known as estrogen receptor negative. That means that it can't be treated with things like estrogen blockers, which are a very normal course of treatment in North America and Europe. The other thing that we found is that those women might be more susceptible to an inherited form of breast cancer.
And so it's where you sit or where you originate geographically or maybe even racially seems to be a key factor here. Peggy Porter, is the medical world looking at this that way as they look more and more at the world map of breast cancer?
They are. There are several studies going on to try to better understand the genetics of the disease. And Fumi Olapade is one of the researchers, University of Chicago, who's been studying the genetics in Africa as well as the genetics here in the United States. We have as well, we've looked at a lot of tumors from black women and from white women and compared them and really are finding that there are biological differences in those tumors that may suggest that race at least is a surrogate for some kind of difference in the way in what kind of breast cancers women would get.
Mm. Kathleen Kingsbury, I've just got you for another half minute. You're based in Shanghai. Do you see China awakening to this, stepping up when it comes to diagnosis and treatment and looking at root causes, or is it still under the, you know, sort of in the closet?
I think, Tom, that there's still a long way to go. In the major cities, they're extremely educated, very, very dedicated doctors. But outside of those major cities, there's still a lack of awareness. One of the biggest projects going on right now is a project to give 1 million Chinese women a mammogram for free. Well, unfortunately, there are 500 million women in China, and only a small percentage are being reached.
That's a small fraction, and that's where there's an effort. Kathleen Kingsbury with Time Magazine, lead author on a big cover story this week on global breast cancer. Kathleen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Peggy Porter, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us as well, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about breast cancer worldwide and the growing international crisis in women's health. In the USA, we have the world's highest incidence of breast cancer, but rates and awareness are growing right around the planet. You can join the conversation this hour. Will the whole world one day have to face breast cancer rates as high as the US and Europe's? And does economic progress globally mean breast cancer? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Seattle, Washington, by Dr. Peggy Porter, head of the breast cancer program at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. She's been studying new factors in the lives of women in developing countries that may be causing a rise in breast cancer there. We're joined right now from one of these frontiers, from Nairobi, Kenya. We're joined by Mary Onyango. She is herself a survivor of breast cancer, first diagnosed in 1999. She is now executive director of the Kenya Breast Health Program. Mary Onyango, thank you very much for being with us from Nairobi. Hello, Mary Onyango, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Mary Onyango, thank you very, very much for joining us. Tell us the situation, if you would, of women in Kenya who get breast cancer. What portion are diagnosed correctly? What portion get treatment?
A lot of our women are actually not diagnosed properly, mainly because breast cancer has not really been seen as an issue for our women. And you find that when doctors are in hospital settings, they tend to see a lot of benign breast diseases. You know, you'll have a lot of mastitis, mm-hmm. A lot of other things that are not benign. So there's always the tendency that when women present with lumps or with breast discharges, the first thing somebody will think of is to put them on an antibiotic, which then, of course, means that there's a lot of delay in terms of diagnosis. To make matters worse, before you come out with a breast cancer diagnosis, you need to have some tissue diagnosis, which means you need to have a good lab. We don't have many good labs out there, and even where there are labs, you may not be able to get a cytologist who can actually work on diagnosis or on a cancer diagnosis. So we find that all this contributes to a delay in women getting diagnosed on time.
Mary, I'm looking here at statistics from the International Agency for Research on Cancer that show that in East Africa, while the incidence is the incidence of breast cancer is much lower than in, let's say, the United States, but the mortality rate, the death rate of those who do get breast cancer, looks to me to be extraordinarily high here, maybe 70 or 80%. Does that square with your experience?
Yeah, that's true, because when we do our free breast screening clinics, we kind of see the women that we end up picking and who end up with a cancer breast cancer diagnosis. Actually, we find that in the screening clinics we've run the last 5 years, over 80% actually present with stage 3 and 4 disease, which means it's a challenge in terms of survival. You know that for somebody to survive with a stage 3 or stage 4, you need to really have aggressive treatment, which means that, which translates into cost. Most of these women can then not afford the kind of treatment they would be required to take in order to survive a stage 3, stage 4 breast cancer diagnosis.
What percentage of women in Kenya get regular mammograms, and what percentage of those diagnosed with breast cancer have access to chemotherapy or radiation therapy?
I wouldn't say that many of our women actually get mammography, especially the screening mammography. If you look at the fact that the country has, we are about 34 million, 15 million plus are actually women. And for those 15 million women, we have, right now the country has 12 mammography units.
Wow.
So screening mammography is out of question. Not many women do that, apart from maybe a few who may already be aware or maybe have had an experience. Most of the mammographies being done now are actually diagnostic mammographies, in which case the woman has already presented with a problem, and maybe the doctor wants to find out a little more, so they will then ask them to do a mammography. So screening mammography, hardly there. I wouldn't even want to talk of percentages because I think it's a drop in the bucket. In terms of accessing chemotherapy, I think not many of them can access chemotherapy. You know that if you look at, by the time you go through the entire regime of even the most basic chemotherapy, the CAF, you're looking, these women are looking at something close to like $1,000, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not many of them can talk of $1,000 when, you know, you have a population where more than 50% are living on less than a dollar a day. That just becomes a luxury.
Ms. Onyango, there in Nairobi, do you see changes in the lifestyle of Kenyan women, that might be contributing to a surge in breast cancer?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of lifestyle changes. A lot of us are adopting more Western lifestyles. One, you look at our diet, it's a lot more different. You look at issues like our history as far as having children are concerned. In olden times, our grandmothers used to have several kids. I mean, it wasn't strange to see a woman with up to 10 kids. I know a lady who had 16 children.
Mm.
But these days, on average, people, you know, you get a family of three, that is really big, you know. So women are getting fewer and fewer children. They're also starting to get their children a lot later. Many people want to go to school. You want to go to college. You want to get a job. You want to get kind of started off in life before you start talking kids. So it means that many women are actually getting their first children much, much later. And some are even opting to go through life without kids. You look at if you look at the young girls now, a lot of our girls are actually getting their menarche or the first menstrual cycles very early. We've got girls as young as 9-year-olds starting to have menstrual cycles. So, you know, there are lots of lifestyle changes with that, which actually could be contributing to this rising incidence of breast cancer that we are seeing.
And what about cultural factors that might affect Kenyan women's willingness to speak of breast cancer if they suspect it? Do they feel free to talk about it?
I think, you know, the interesting thing is that culturally, for us, breast was never really like a sexual issue.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at in earlier women, you know, they actually used to walk around topless. And
yep.
The breast was just there for feeding kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
It was just like any other part of the body that really was not, it wasn't a big issue. But, you know, with the adoption of Western lifestyles, we've also tended to pick up this, may I call it Western belief, that the breast is a sexual organ. And that has then contributed in people not being able to discuss the breast. You know, you kind of tend to feel that the breast is what defines you as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants to be defined as not being a woman, especially if you're a woman. We've got incidences where people lose their partners when they are found to have breast cancer. Nobody wants to go through life ostracized for something like that. So there's also the issue of people not even knowing much about this disease. So you don't know whether it's contagious. You know it definitely kills. You look at the African continent. The one thing that we know really, really kills is HIV/AIDS, which has a lot of sexual connotations and mm-hmm. stigma to it. So this death thing, which nobody knows how it comes, it's affecting an organ which is, you know, in most people's minds, a sexual organ. You know, you don't want to expose yourself to, you know, not having some issues around your sexuality, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you find that many women then tend to just keep quiet. They don't want to talk about it. And if they are ready to accept that they have it, they would rather probably not even go through a mastectomy and just say, well, I'd rather die and die with my breast.
Wow. And die they do. Mary Nyong'o, Executive Director of the Kenya Breast Health Program. Ms. Nyong'o, you paint a vivid picture for us and a very insightful one. I want to thank you for joining us today from Nairobi.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us. Peggy Porter, there's the word from, one of the many, I guess you could call them, front lines here. I mean, she's so clear in explaining what's going on, but what she's describing sounds to my ears like a very frightening picture for Kenyan women, for example.
It is really difficult, and that was really beautifully put, and I think it's the issue that many countries are facing, and they are in a situation where the resources are really fighting other diseases and poverty and starvation in a way that makes it difficult to even know how you turn the resources around to breast cancer. I think that one of the things that the Time article brought up and that she exemplifies very much is that it's advocacy programs that really have the power to change a country's attitude toward breast cancer. So in our country, for instance, I think that it was never so extreme. But if you look 50 years ago, you'll see a lot of cultural
inhibitions,
reticence
on, mm-hmm.
to say that you have breast cancer. And then, you know, we kind of think of Betty Ford as being the president's wife who first came out and publicly said that she had breast cancer. And advocacy has built up in this country to change the face of research and women's understanding. And I think that as the Time article put forward, advocacy groups in other countries are really like the first step in making this happen.
First, advocacy to be able to speak about it, but then there's the whole issue of detection and treatment, and those doing great in the U.S., but lagging far behind in many countries. Peggy Porter, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Madison, Wisconsin, Dr. Richard Love. He's an oncologist who's been tracking the rise in breast cancer globally, scientific director of the International Breast Cancer Research Foundation. He's a senior investigator researching global cancer problems for the National Cancer Institute. Dr. Love, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It sounds a bit overwhelming when we see the availability of diagnosis and treatment in many of these countries where the incidence appears to be on the rise. How do we begin? How does the world begin to grapple with these numbers?
Well, I think about the problem in three ways. I think we have to think about the characteristics of the cancer itself and the people that are getting disease. Secondly, we have to think, as we've been discussing, about the culture in which things occur. The challenges of misinformation, myths, and the fact that all of us have personal representations of illness. whether we're in the West or we live in Asia. And these representations of illness guide how we're going to react when we develop a problem.
What do you mean by representations of illness, Dr. Love? What do you mean by
that? That we all have ideas about changes in our bodies as they develop and what they mean and what has caused them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, and what the consequences are. In our work in Bangladesh, this issue of economic resources is important, but consider how it impacts on a woman who finds that she develops a lump. As best we can understand the situation of rural Bangladeshi women, what happens is what they're concerned about is the economic consequences for their families should they require some medical attention that demands money from their families. The consequences are that their children won't have some schooling benefits, some food, other things, and mothers in that circumstance act very nobly and sacrifice for their children.
And so right? the trade-off's so real.
It's how they put the whole situation together in their culture.
Mm, the trade-off's real there, and the mother choosing a very real risk to her health in that circumstance. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dr. Love, the third factor you were about to go to there?
Is just to say that obviously we're working in different health systems, all right? And a country like Bangladesh has a ratio of 1 to 2 physicians per 100,000 population, all right? Mm. That's a significantly different situation than occurs in many Western countries. So health systems are very complicated, and we have to think about if we're going to tackle a problem like breast cancer, how does this fit in the complex of challenges that health systems in that particular country are facing?
Looks like a huge challenge. Peggy Porter, Richard Love, please stand by. I want to begin to welcome in our listeners. Brenda is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was listening. It's very interesting, the whole conversation. And earlier on, you were talking, or one of your guests, I think Kathleen, was talking about how when women have more babies earlier on in life, that their risk of breast cancer decreases.
As a general rule, though perhaps not for individuals, yes.
Yes, as a general rule. And I just wondered if one of your guests could address how breastfeeding also decreases the incidence of breast cancer in women, and that the number of years that a woman is breastfeeding a child actually decreases in years her potential for getting breast cancer.
Brenda,
not as an individual, but as a general rule.
Yeah, let us look at exactly that. Peggy Porter, what about it? Birth rate, number of childbirths, and breastfeeding, how do you see those factoring in when we look at breast cancer, and how do you see trends globally that might raise those as issues here?
Those factors do increase the risk overall for breast cancer. Certainly,
fewer children and less breastfeeding.
When you have your children, increases the risk more overall. Breastfeeding and breastfeeding for longer periods of time will decrease risk overall in looking at the population, but mm-hmm. that's not as strong a risk factor as when you have your children.
So earlier means, in general, less risk. Later, children, more risk? Do I understand that correctly? I don't want to get it wrong.
When you have your children earlier and have more children, there's a decreased risk. If you breastfeed and breastfeed longer, you have a decreased risk.
Richard Love, with both of these then changing globally, women having, as the country's economies develop, maybe fewer children and maybe having them later, and maybe because they're working in new circumstances, breastfeeding less, does that mean just those factors alone that we're destined to be on an upward march in terms of breast cancer incidence worldwide?
Well, yes, I think those factors are contributing to an increased case burden and increased incidence rates. On the other hand, I'd like to present this perspective. Mm-hmm. The rates for breast cancer in various communities with good population registries in India are approximately a quarter of the highest rates in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So if our living circumstances and it is suspected likely our diets were like those of our friends in India, the picture of global breast cancer would be significantly different. I would submit that that strongly suggests that one area in which we should invest our precious research dollars is in investigating what that's all about.
We'll look at that and much more when we come back. Dr. Richard Love with us today from Madison, Wisconsin, and Dr. Peggy Porter with us from Seattle. Please stand by. Listeners, you can join the conversation. What do you think? Does less childbirth plus a richer diet equal somehow breast cancer? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about breast cancer worldwide with growing rates and awareness now globally. We've been joined by Dr. Peggy Porter from the Breast Cancer Program at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and by Dr. Richard Love, an oncologist who's been tracking the rise in breast cancer globally. He works with the International Breast Cancer Research Foundation and the National Cancer Institute. He's a professor of internal medicine and public health at Ohio State University. You can join the conversation. What do you think? What are you seeing on the American front, I guess we should ask? Are we making progress here? And what happens to the world's women if they get the breast cancer but not the mammograms, the MRI, the chemo, the treatment? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Judy in Fayston, Vermont. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
And hello to you all, and thank you so much. Excellent. I am very interested in science and medicine, and I'm also very interested in accurate information.
Mm-hmm.
In mentioning diet, I think there's something that has a direct influence on us in what we eat and how we prepare it, especially, and that is plastic. A friend of mine had breast cancer, and her doctor told her not to drink bottled water. It's because of the plasticizers, the softening agents in the plastic, and I never do. In my chemical dictionary, there are two lines here which are, I think, very important. Under plastics, quote, plastics in general, including all forms, are sensitive to high temperatures, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And then under polyvinyl chloride, PVC, which is a plasticizer which gives plastic
flexibility. It's plasticity.
Yeah. Yes. Quote, its use in thinner items such as films and packaging coatings is permissible. Possibility of migration of vinyl chloride monomer into food products is the critical factor.
So I would guess you're not throwing lunch in the microwave in a plastic dish anymore.
I never have. Especially people they advertise, you know, cooking in plastic.
Yep.
I will never use a saran wrap or anything like that around food. I don't use it.
Judy, let us turn to our medical guests to see what they have to say about this, and thank you very much. Peggy Porter, Richard Love, do you have research or insights to offer here?
Well, I think that it's very difficult to do the kind of studies that would nail this down perfectly, but I think that there have been several studies and a couple of really good ones that have tried to look at toxins and PCBs and whatnot as causes of breast cancer. And the association has not been found. It doesn't mean that there isn't one that we can't measure, but we really don't see that at the level that we see some of these other reproductive risk factors some of the risk factors, essentially, you know, alcohol, for instance, or exercise. So although I think that, you know, we can't rule out something because we haven't really been able to test it perfectly, but we don't have evidence to suggest that the external toxins are really putting women at great risk. You have to remember that when we talk about risk factors for breast cancer, we're talking about things that aren't overall make the risk increase, but we don't really know anything about what causes breast cancer. There's not anything that's a risk like smoking related to lung cancer,
the direct
where the risk
cause
is
and
enormously
effect.
High. So we don't really have that kind of cause effect in breast cancer.
Dr. Love, what do you hear in Judy's concern about plastics? And to take it more broadly, I mean, we've talked about kind of life and childbirth issues. There's diet. The people write about the meat/sweet diet of what had been the West as being a problem. Judy pulls the curtain on back to environmental issues, starting with a plastic wrapper right around food. In that whole spectrum, where do you see the greatest weight of causality, if we can look at it that way?
Well, I think the important point that's being made here, and you talked about broadening the discussion, is the gap between ideas, hypotheses we may have about causes, about how best to tackle the breast cancer problem, and facts. All right. And my position is that across the board, in better understanding causation, in better understanding how to intervene in populations in specific cultures, in better understanding health systems, what we desperately need is better research and more research.
Let's take a call from Elizabeth in Brookline, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. My question is about difference between incidence and ability to diagnose. The problem might be that in third world countries we are more able to diagnose and there is not really a higher incidence of breast cancer. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Yes, Elizabeth, thank you. Peggy Porter, what about it? There's always the suspicion that these apparent growing numbers may just be greater awareness, that it's always been a problem. In your community, is it certain that we've got a growing problem here?
Well, I think in some countries it's very difficult to know whether you have a growing problem. In the United States, you have to remember this very high incidence of breast cancer includes it comes from a very highly screened population mm-hmm. where very, very small cancers and sometimes even non-invasive cancers are being counted in that incidence. And the incidence in countries where there's really virtually no screening, you're really looking at the incidence of, as was said very beautifully by Marion, mm-hmm. the latest stage disease. So in some ways you can say you'd be looking at the tip of the iceberg and that the incidence is really quite more than that. And in other cases you might say that the incidence is actually less. We just don't have those data. And I think that goes back to what we all want, our data. I think that detecting this disease is the key to decreasing mortality, and that's the real problem in developing countries.
Richard Love, detection obviously huge and environmental issues extremely important, but then we come to treatment, and I think the thing that stumps me when I look at this map spread before me here and what appears to be rising incidence is knowing the cost of some of the more common treatments in the United States. I mean, as Mary Onyango in Nairobi said, they're very costly. You know, just a mammogram or MRI, never mind chemotherapy, radiation, or the new genetic analysis that's going on. If we're going to have a growing awareness and perhaps a growing incidence globally, how do we begin to address this economically in terms of treatment? It looks overwhelming.
Well, I think one framework we need to operate within is one akin to or similar to those that have been used and discussed in approaching AIDS globally. And that is to say that we need to think about partnerships with different organizations in this issue more so than we have in the past. Let me give an example. In Bangladesh, we've partnered with a rural information technology or a rural computer education group called Amader Gram. This idea of partnering with development organizations that are working in different areas is one that has taken hold and is being used in different parts of the world. This partnership has allowed us access to women coming into computer training classes that otherwise wouldn't get information and get an opportunity to pay attention to the possibility of breast problems.
But does a partnership put chemotherapy within reach of a Bangladeshi villager or genetic analysis or radiation or any of what is a fairly standard treatment package in the U.S., let's say?
Well, the second thing I'd say is that Yes, we very much need public health approaches to treatment. I think one assumption that's being made here is that treatment approaches in different populations, one shoe fits all. Yeah. And I think it's becoming clear that that isn't true at all. I said earlier that characteristics of the person are important choices or at least in outcomes in terms of breast cancer. What I was referring to is increased data suggesting that different forms of key genes that are responsible for metabolizing treatment drugs,
right,
different forms of these genes exist in different populations. As a result, certain treatments can be of increased or decreased efficacy, as they're usually given, or increased or decreased toxicities, as they're usually given, in different populations. We have some early data about this, for example, with respect to Asian populations, suggesting that, in fact, with respect to our major forms of treatment, anti-estrogen treatment with tamoxifen and chemotherapy, these issues are very, very important.
But does that mean that there's an economical response to millions of new cases around the world that would be a substitute for the sort of heavy chemo or radiation, genetic analysis, and everything we see in the States? Is there really something that's dramatically less expensive that, that could be offered these women?
I think, in fact, there are some strategies that we need to investigate that can be more appropriately determined to be public health strategies, strategies that can be more widely applied. And I think the economic issues can be dealt with better than we've dealt with them, assuming simply that the costs are going to be what the costs are in Western countries. Simply beginning to think about economies of scale is one way of bringing the costs down.
And maybe some different delivery packages as well. Nestle's calling from Milton, Massachusetts. Nestle, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm calling about the statue of therapy for black women and minority women here in America.
Yes.
And I think your guest has talked about the level of treatment around the world, in Africa and Asia. My question is, to what extent that minority women I receive the best therapy, and to what extent also that the research is in fact applying to their to the specificities of their race right here in America?
It's a good question, Nestle. Thank you very much. Peggy Porter, what about it? Bring the circle right back home for us for minority populations, and let's add for poor populations in the United States. Do they get equal treatment, and is there equally in-depth research about the particular nature of breast cancer they may face?
Well, there is definitely a lot of research going on in this area, and people are very interested in it. I think that your caller is absolutely right. There are health disparities in this country, and they relate to cultural differences, to access to care, resource, socioeconomic status. All of those things really matter in healthcare in this country as well. So we've been looking at this question in comparing blacks and whites in terms of their access to care, but also in terms of the biology of the disease, trying to tease out what is it that's a disparity because of care differences, and what are the disparities that are because of different biologies of the disease. And I think we know that both things are going on, and have a handle now in looking at those tumors of black women, for instance, knowing that they tend to get their cancers earlier. Actually, under 45, black women have a higher incidence of breast cancer than white women in this country. And those cancers that they get tend to be more aggressive and more difficult to treat.
Let's take a call from Enfield, Connecticut. Basha, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's really an incredible observation and realization for myself. I have left Kashmir, India, 40 years ago, and I have had... Well, my mom, she had six children. I had more than 26 aunts and zillions of cousins who all have more than 3, 4, 5, 6 kids, mm-hmm. and there was one aunt, she couldn't bear the child, have the kid, and she was the only person that suffered from breast cancer, but was fortunate enough, her son, who was a laboratory technician in the hospital, one and only hospital at the time in Srinagar, Kashmir, she survived. They had to remove their breasts, and she survived it. But it was really an incredible thing to listen to from Nairobi, yes, we were listening.
Basha, let me ask you, do you fear that in a new generation, which may have fewer children as economic opportunities rise, that may change? Your family may be less apparently immune to breast cancer than those that former situation brought about.
You're asking me for a recommendation. I would say world is already getting too many people. We need to really learn how to really create, how to be more creative in helping all these people medically. And, you know, that's because if you're asking me that, because then India right now, such a great country and progressing and 40% poverty and produce more is not going to help. So,
But the era of two dozen aunts may be moving behind India, at least in some parts of that population. Peggy Porter, Richard Love, our time grows short. Dr. Love, first to you. I mean, what's your big advice, goal, focus now when it comes to this global breast cancer situation?
I think the big challenge is defining a research agenda that covers the areas that we've touched on. The kinds of cancers that occur in different populations, how individuals in different populations with different genetic backgrounds handle the kinds of treatments that we have now, increasing our emphasis on studying cultures and increasing our emphasis on studying health systems in different parts of the world. I think selfishly in the United States, it's very much in our interest, particularly, of course, given that we're a polyglot society, in studying breast cancer in other countries, because mm-hmm. we can learn things that are going to help us generally with understanding breast cancer and also specifically with understanding how better to approach some situations in immigrant populations.
For our whole population with all its ethnic diversity, and Peggy Porter, the last word goes to you. Given that we've got development going on in all kinds of corners of the world now with everything that may entail the way we develop, at least now, do you fear that we're at the beginning of yet another steep climb? Even as treatment becomes better and detection may get better, is it inevitable that we're going to see a lot more breast cancer globally?
Well, I think that that's probably true. I think that the incidence will go up for the reasons that we've talked about, increased measuring, and I think that there are some things that are going to changes that are going to drive the incidence up. I think what's really important to me, and I think to women, is the mortality rate and dying of that cancer. And I think we know in this country that it is very difficult to treat late stage disease. Almost impossible to cure late-stage disease. Women who are caught in an early stage are going to live from their disease. And I think one of the things that we need to do is to figure out how in other countries can we detect this earlier so that women have less of a chance of dying of the disease that they get.
Let that be a hope globally and a lot more with it. Peggy Porter in Seattle at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, thank you for being here. And Richard Love of Ohio State University, thanks to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.